Okay, so what we'd like to do is to, before we initiate any study related to Patanjali, this is a kind of an invocation to sage Patanjali, and you know we normally we start with this invocation, and there's a little tune to it, so I'm going to kind of sing that tune, and you can just listen and read it on the screen, okay? And then we'll read the meaning later on. So it's in Sanskrit, okay? Yogena chittasya padena vacham malam sharirasya cha vaidyakena yopakarottam pravaram muninam patanjalim pranjaliranatosmi patanjalim pranjaliranatosmi. So this is the invocation to sage Patanjali. And one of you, Nicole, you want to read the meaning in English?
I respectfully bow down with folded hands and offer my salutations to sage Patanjali, the highest among the Munis sages, who has presented the remedies for removing the impurities of the body through his treatise on Ayurveda, of language through his treatise on grammar, Patanjala
Mahabhashya. Yep.
And the impurities of the Chitta mind field through his treatise on Yoga, Yoga Sutras of Patanjali.
Okay. So this is just to give you an idea of how great a figure Patanjali was. I mean, he is attributed, he is given the credit for all these three fields of human endeavor. You know, they're the three most important fields, right? Mind, body, and speech. Three of the most important things, and he is given the credit for giving us the science for all three. Okay, so his contribution to medicine for cleansing the body, physical body, it's called Ayurveda. Anybody, everyone familiar with the term Ayurveda? Okay, so he's one of the most important authors of the original Ayurveda text in medicine. Then he is the most renowned commentator for one of the ancient Sanskrit grammars. Okay, the grammarian's name was Panini, and he wrote the most important, most authoritative, and most well-known commentary on that grammar. So he is very, very well known as a grammarian, Sanskrit grammar. So that's the purity of the speech. And finally, of course, he gave us the whole science of yoga. So that's the purity of the yoga. Yoga is for the purity of what?
Mind.
Okay. So Ayurveda for the purity of the body, grammar for the purity of the speech, and yoga for the purity of the mind. Okay. So that's what the whole emphasis on Patanjali, okay? Oh, before we go on, can we just go through a very quick introduction, just so I know who you are, like, what's your background, and what kind of work you do, and just like that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm Lydia, and I have been practicing yoga since I was in high school. It was a class at my high school, so that's how I got introduced. It's a blessing that I had at a young age. And now I've just always been called to be a teacher. So I've always been called to be a teacher.
Yoga teacher?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So that's why I'm here. I also have my holistic health certification, so I could coach people if I wanted to. But I kind of want to have the dual teaching so that I can really help people overall.
Okay, so do you work somewhere, or is it?
I do work. I work at a dental office right now.
I see.
So it's really good hours. It's 8 to 5. I still have weekends.
Good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Jill. I'm an oncology pharmacist. I work at the VA, and I work with, well, four veterans, obviously, but I work with genomics. And so I work with using DNA to try to individualize medicine.
Wow.
And I really was attracted to yoga because I know I'm a pharmacist, but I feel like medicines are too much of a reaction, and I'd like to see, you know, I think for things like pain and especially things with the mind, I feel like there are other things besides medicine that can be used. And I think the other reason is in medicine right now, there really is a lot of discussion on burnout, and of physicians, nurses, pharmacists, and staff. And so I feel like this can be very helpful, especially with trainees, to teach them in that competitive, high-stress environment how to keep yourself peaceful and
at ground level.
Yeah, so I'm thankful to be here.
Thank you. Wonderful. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I've started little by little introducing yoga and mindfulness to my students.
Wow.
And it's been amazing. Cool. And a few of them actually have a little background through their families. Their families also practice. So that's been just, it's been a really cool connection. In fact, I had a student that gave me this meditation book for Christmas. It was like a really...
A fifth grade?
Yes. And he was very adamant that I read it right away. And he was asking me, have you read it? It's just been a neat way to connect with kids on
a
different level. So I'm interested in doing yoga with children. But also, personally, I'm a runner and an athlete, and I really am interested in using yoga as a way to prevent injury and kind of the yoga for the athlete concept.
Very good.
So, yeah, those are my two kind of interests with yoga right now, but we'll see.
Thank you.
I'm just on the journey.
Enjoy the journey, as
absolutely
they say. Thank you. Yes. Okay.
I sell Burt's Bees lip balm.
What do they sell?
Burt's Bees lip balm and various like natural body products.
Okay.
So that's my day job, and then I've been doing yoga too since I was back in high school. I got started through a soccer coach brought in a yoga instructor, which is kind of cool for that day and age. And I've just really always, it's been part of my life since then. And then I guess what brought me to want to be a teacher is I was diagnosed with breast cancer when I was 33. And I think it had a lot to do with burnout and, you know, the lifestyle that we have. And so kind of brought me much deeper into my practice. And now as a survivor, I kind of see other people, you know, that were in my shoes. And I know how much yoga helped me. So it felt like it was the right time.
Excellent. Wow. Thank you. Anna.
My name is Anna. I'm a personal trainer and nutritionist. And I've been practicing yoga for the past like 7 years, maybe. I've been through all the
microses, I know.
And that's where actually I fell in love with yoga and I learned more about the concepts, which kind of got me more and more interested. So I established my meditation and breathing practice after doing your intensives. And I've been doing since through, and I wanted to incorporate that more with my clients. I see at the gym, I see a lot of imbalances, you know, a lot of disequilibrium and people exercising for the wrong reasons, you know. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to bring the yoga into that and to kind of better my practice. So I just sound like I'm enjoying.
Yeah,
the
rise. Very nice. Thank you. Thank you for sharing your story. It's wonderful. Yeah, so glad. Okay, so so once again, getting back to this invocation, The thing that we want to get out of this is that the yoga is predominantly for the mind. You know, that's the whole purpose of yoga. And as we go through these slides and discussions, we will realize that Patanjali had only the mind in mind, you know, when he talked about yoga. Okay. So what we will do is to kind of spend the first half of this session on the Yoga Sutras, and then take a short 5-10 minute break maybe, and then spend the remaining time for Bhagavad Gita. All right, so that's what we'll do. From what Dharma told me, that you are already fairly exposed to some of the main concepts of Yoga Sutras. You have been, and you've been studying the 8 limbs of yoga, I believe. Mm-hmm. So you're quite familiar. That always is a challenge for me as to what I should focus on, but you know, I'll do my best, okay? So we'll see how we take it from here. So I'm going to start with the definition of yoga, and I'm sure you're familiar with that. And the first 4 sutras, they are focused on how to understand the definition of yoga. The first 4 sutras. Okay, the first one is this statement here that I'm now going to give you an exposure to this whole discipline of yoga. Okay, that's the first sutra itself in the chapter 1. Before we go on, does everyone know that there are, how many chapters are there in the Yoga Sutras? 4. Not everyone knows that. No, okay. You tell me. No, I need to know that, because you know, tell me yes or no if you know that, because then
I. 4. I'm going to go with 4.
Okay, does anybody know the names of those 4 chapters?
No.
No, okay. Okay, so let me just start with that. I kind of assume that you know all that. Okay, let me. So the first chapter is called Samadhi Pada. Okay, Samadhi Pada. Pada is the Sanskrit word for a chapter. Okay? Normally spelled as P-A-D-A, but P-A-A-D-A. So Samadhi Pada is the first chapter, okay? Samadhi is what? What's Samadhi?
Your true self state, right?
True self state, yes. So when you've attained a state where your mind is completely devoid of all kind of perturbations, that's the state of Samadhi. It's also one of the 8 limbs of yoga, and we'll come to that, okay? So the first chapter defines yoga. It also defines some of the techniques to attain the final state of yoga. And then it goes into a fair amount of discussion on this state of samadhi, or the practice of samadhi, and different stages of samadhi. Okay? All right, so that's the first chapter. The second chapter is called Sadhana Pada. Sadhana, okay? Sadhana literally means the technique or the methodology of doing something. Okay? So obviously then Sadhana Pada would imply that it's going to tell you how to practice yoga. And that's where, toward the end of that chapter, Patanjali introduces the 8 limbs of yoga. Okay? Okay? But the first part of the chapter, of the second chapter, has to do with understanding what causes the suffering in the mind. The term Patanjali uses is klesha, K-L-E-S-H-A, Sanskrit term. Klesha means suffering or stress, or you know, all kinds of mental pain that people go through. So that's what he talks about in the initial part of second chapter. And he gives 5 different kind of causes of suffering, and we'll go through that, okay? In the second chapter, he also continues to go and discuss this whole concept of reincarnation. What is reincarnation? What is rebirth? How do you get to, you know, what does it mean when the body dies and when you get into the new birth, etc., etc.? All that is covered in the second chapter. Okay? And then finally, he introduces the concept of the 8 limbs of yoga, where he says, you know, these are the things that can be attained when you practice the 8 limbs of yoga, and the ultimate goal being, of course, final liberation from this mess that we are in, basically. I mean, we're all in a mess, basically.
Yeah.
So So basically he says that we can practice these eight limbs of yoga to get rid of this complete, you know, this suffering that we go through. And then we will not have to go through this whole cycle of reincarnation, rebirth, death and all that. We're done, basically. We're home. It's a home run after that. Okay. That's in the second chapter. Third chapter is called Vibhuti Pada. Vibhuti. Vibhuti is the Sanskrit term which means supernormal powers. Supernatural, supernormal powers. Okay. And what the third chapter says, that through meditation on different aspects of our being, different things, different entities that you meditate on, you can attain powers that are beyond normal human powers. Okay? So they are supernormal powers. Okay? So he goes into a lot of discussion on what these powers are and how to attain those, or how they can be attained. But then he gives a very strong and stern warning toward the end of that chapter. He says, look, these powers, you may attain some of these powers, but do not get hung up on these. They are an obstruction, they are an obstacle to your growth into your pure spiritual being. Therefore, don't get hung up on them. They may come, enjoy them, but go through, you know, go past them. Don't get your ego boosted. Oh my God, I can walk on water, and I can see beyond the walls and all that. No, don't get hung up on that. Okay? So that's the chapter number 3, Vibhuti Pada. Then the chapter number 4 is called Kaivalya Pada. Okay, that's the name of the chapter, Kaivalya Pada. And the word Kaivalya literally means somewhat close to freedom. You know, that's the word I can... closest word would be freedom or separation is another meaning, isolation, freedom. And freedom from what? Freedom from?
Cycle.
Freedom from the cycle of birth and rebirth. But again, freedom from our bondage, basically. The mind is in a state of bondage. And freedom from that bondage. And we'll talk about that, what that bondage entails and what it means in this context here. Okay. So those are the four chapters, and there is the total of 195 sutras in this collection of four. Okay, 195. There are some texts which give an extra sutra in the chapter 3, so it becomes 196. But, you know, mostly 195. Okay. So that's the total number. And these sutras are very, if you have seen these, they are very kind of crisp sutras. You know, they're very brief, cryptic. And there was a strong reason to be that way. Why did they have to be cryptic? Why did they have to be so brief? Why did they have to be so almost non-understandable? You know.
I think, I would imagine it would be so that people interpret it in the way that makes sense through their lens. No? Okay.
Maybe not everyone is ready. Hmm? Not everyone is ready to understand them.
No. The main reason is because how do you transmit this knowledge to future generations? How do you do that? Did you have printing press that time?
Verbally.
Verbally passed down. How do you do it verbally? Only if you can memorize them.
Right.
How do you memorize them? Only if they are short and brief.
Right.
If you have huge text, you know,
Yeah. You
cannot memorize that.
Right.
Okay. So, in most literature that you will find in the ancient area, they are either written in the form of verse, which can be sung or which can be memorized as a verse, which has a meter. It's much easier to remember a verse. But if these are just statements, they had to be very, very brief and very crisp, okay? Very cryptic. Okay? So that's the reason why they are so cryptic. When I say cryptic, it's almost entirely impossible to understand the meaning unless you read a commentary. Mm-hmm. Okay? Without commentary, you cannot understand these. They just don't make sense. And therefore, people had to rely on somebody's authentic, reliable commentary. So, who is the most reliable and authoritative commentator on the Yoga Sutras? What's the name of the most reliable commentator?
Isn't it this one, Swami
Sachin? No. He's very recent.
These
were written 3,000 years ago, right?
Yeah.
There had to be a commentator around that time.
Yeah.
Otherwise, nobody would know what that means.
Is it Viva Kananda?
Come on.
Is that it?
No.
I know what you're saying, though.
The name is Vyasa. Vyasa.
Okay.
Oh, yes.
Start with
Vyasa. V-A-S-A. V-Y-A-S-A.
Okay. Yes.
The commentary by Vyasa is the most authoritative, most respected, and most ancient commentary that people go by. Okay. Mm-hmm. Almost every other commentator worth any salt, if you can say, had to rely on that commentary first, understand that, and then give his or her own views on the Yoga Sutras. Okay. So that's the reason they're very short, very cryptic, and almost non-understandable. Okay. So with that introduction, let's quickly go through now these sutras, okay? So, the first one is, like I said here, right now, you guys are ready, I'm ready. You know, I prepared you up to this day. Maybe, you know, the culture was that the students would live with the teacher for many years and they would learn all other aspects of learning, you know, math, science, literature, all the scriptures, maybe some fighting, etc., all that was given. And now I have prepared you enough and you're ready for receiving this knowledge of yoga, this wisdom of yoga. So that's the first statement. Okay. Now, the commentary by Vyasa, you know, what he says that because yoga is all about the mind, it's a good idea to understand what kind of states the mind can be in. Okay. So what he says that when you're going through your practice of yoga or you're going through these states of meditation, you can be in any one of these five states of the mind. Okay? And this is from the commentary by Vyasa. And almost everybody kind of mentions these in their understanding of yoga. Okay? So the first state, he says, is the very disturbed or a scattered state. Okay? Which is the state which is most commonly we are in all the time. Because the mind is constantly churning thoughts, ideas, emotions, constantly. And we jump from one thought to the next at absolutely no rhythm whatsoever. Okay? So that state is called the disturbed or the scattered state. Okay? Then the next state he talks about is called the dull state, sleepy state. Somnolent is the word that many commentators use, okay? Which is the state when you are either physically exhausted or just mentally completely like, you know, when they say, oh, my mind is fried right now, you know, something like that. You make a statement like that, right? I can't think straight. You know. All I want to do is sit on a couch, have a bag of potato chips, a glass of beer and watch football or something like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing. I can't do anything else. That's the mudha state. Then vikshipta is the partially distracted state now. I should say partially focused or partially distracted state. This is when you have now maybe started the practice of meditation. And then your mind, when you're meditating, you know that your mind will go away and then you can bring it back into a little bit of a focus or a concentration and then focus on your object of meditation. So that's the partially distracted state called vikshipta. Then you get into this one-pointed state where the mind has now learned how to stay focused on that single object that you're trying to focus on in your meditation. That's called the ekagra state. And finally, you get into the state called Niruddha, or the fully controlled, or fully focused, or fully inward focused state, where your mind is now in a state where you're not bombarded by too many thoughts. Okay? That's the state of the Niruddha state. Right? So, let me skip this. Because this is from the Vedanta school of thinking. See, when it says Atha Yoga Anushasana, that means here now I'm going to present to you this discipline yoga, and you are ready, I am ready, etc. So the readiness of the student is defined by having attained these six qualities, okay? So you can read these. I'm not going to go through these in detail. You know. This is not from the yoga concept. This is from Vedanta philosophy, these six states. Okay, so now this is the most important sutra in the sense that it is the very basic definition of yoga. Have you read this before? Do you want to read the Sanskrit? Try, yeah.
Okay. Yoga, Sita, Vritti, Nirodha.
Right. So let me just repeat this in Sanskrit. You know, this is one sentence, since you're all going to be yoga teachers, I recommend that you memorize this in Sanskrit. It's a good one to memorize in Sanskrit, because it's the very definition, the very fundamental definition of yoga. So let's go through this like an elementary school. So I'm going to one word at a time. Yogash.
Yogash.
Chitta.
Chitta.
Vritti.
Vritti.
Nirodha.
Nirodha.
So one more time. Yogash.
Yogash.
Chitta.
Chitta.
Vritti.
Vritti.
Nirodha.
Nirodha.
Okay. So now, let's understand the words and their meaning. Okay? The first word is yoga, basically, yoga. And what it says is, the definition of yoga is to, if I were to make an English sentence using the Sanskrit words in this phrase, it will be, yoga by definition is nirodha of the vrittis that are present in the chitta. Alright? So let me explain what that means now. Nirodha means control, cessation, elimination, etc., etc. Different meanings are attributed depending on the context. Nirodha means control or stoppage or things like that. Okay, you get that? Then vritti is what?
Modifications
of the mind. All the fluctuations, all the changes, all the constant perturbations that go on in the mind, that's called a vritti. Anything that happens in the mind is a vritti. Okay? If I have an image of something in my mind, that's a vritti. If I have a sound of something in my mind, it's a vritti. If I have an emotion in my mind, that's a vritti. Anything. So that's the vritti. And then what is chitta? Mind. Chitta is the mind field or the mind complex. Okay? Now, it's called mind complex because it is not just the what we use the word mind for is just the one that thinks and all that. But it's the kind of a conglomerate of multiple concepts, you can say. Multiple functions, so you can say. So then the definition is that yoga is defined as the ability to learn how to suppress or subdue or diminish or eliminate the constant flow of thoughts, feelings, emotions, ideas, everything that goes in the mind. Okay? So that's the definition of yoga. Like I said, it's all about the mind. Basically then, what we can say is yoga is all about calming the mind. How to calm the mind. That's basically it, right? Mm-hmm. How to keep the mind calm despite whatever is happening outside of us or inside of us. Okay? Can we keep mind calm? So, my house burns out, can I stay calm? My car gets stolen, can I stay calm? I have a death in the family, can I stay calm? I lose $1 million in the lottery, in the stock market, can I stay calm? You get the idea. If I get married, can I stay calm? If I don't get married, can I stay calm? If I get a divorce, can I stay calm? Right? I have 2 children in the house, can I stay calm with them? Right? That's the idea. You get the concept, right? Staying calm no matter what the situation is. So, before we go on, you know, this is again what the commentators tell us how to understand this mind, all right? So, I've drawn a little picture based on, you know, my understanding of how these people want us to understand the mind. So, what it says is that let's think of the mind as a composite of 4 major functions. 4 broad categories of function that the mind, this complex mind, does. Okay, what are these 4 functions? So what does the mind do? Let's all think about that. What does the mind do?
Interprets senses from the external.
It gets the input from the out senses, first of all. That's the first thing it does, right? It's called the cognition function, right? Cognition function, right? Getting input from the 5 senses, that's one of the main things. Thinking, basically, is a big, big function. Thinking, right? Based on what you receive, you think about it. You can think about not just receiving input from the 5 senses, but based on what's in the memory, you can think about things, right? You can desire stuff, you can will, you know. Again, emotions happen in the mind. You're angry, you're jealous, you have hatred. All those things are clubbed together in this function called the mind function. Mind. In Sanskrit, the term is manas. Okay? That's the mind function. Now, the second function is intelligently interpreting what the information we get. Intellectual function, it's called. So it's called the intellect. Okay? So, intellect is where we begin to discriminate between right and wrong, good and bad, you know. Different options are provided to us. And the intellect allows us to make choices based on those options. Okay? Now, what's the third function of the mind, of this complex mind?
Memory.
Beautiful. So memory is a big function. Obviously, you know, everything that we experience in life gets stored in the memory. Everything. And then we have a lot of stuff there in the memory. And then what's the fourth function?
I'm not sure about this, but I think he said sleep. No? Okay. Oh, I'm here?
I've listed here. What's the fourth function?
The ego?
Ego.
Okay.
What does the ego do?
A lot of stuff.
Yeah. A lot of stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so you know all that stuff. All right. So, you know, in this book by Satchidananda, he has given a kind of a story which I have put a little more meat around that story to understand how this mind functions. Okay, so let me just go through that story quickly, and that way we'll get an idea of how these 4 functions work together. Okay, so it's like, you know, at the end of the day, you're coming back from work, okay. And by the end of the day, you're probably a little hungry, so you're going to be moving toward the kitchen when you enter the house. And as soon as you get close to the kitchen, you start smelling something nice. So the sense of smell gets engaged. That's where the mind function works. And you go toward the kitchen and then enter the kitchen. And on the kitchen countertop, you see a piece of cake sitting there. Okay, so now your sense of sight is engaged. And their immediate reaction is, okay, let me engage the sense of touch, because you want to dip your finger into the cake and, you know, get a feeling of the texture and all that. And as soon as you do that, you want to engage the sense of
taste.
Taste. You know, you put it on your tongue and then taste it out, Okay, so now all your senses have been engaged, and you have all the information about the cake. Okay, the mind has done its job, getting input from the five senses, and it's got the information. Now, time to decide now, decision time. What are the options?
Eat the cake.
Eat the cake or not to eat the cake. Right? And who is the decision maker?
The intellect.
The intellect. So the mind goes and knocks at the intellect's door. Hey, boss, you know, decision maker, this is the information I have. This is the taste. This is the touch and feel. This is the texture. What do I do? Now, the way things are structured at this moment in our life, the way we are structured, intellect is unable to make independent decisions. Why? Because it has to consult the ego all the time. That's why you all laughed, right?
Yeah.
Ego gets involved in everything.
Yeah, it sure
does. Okay, so intellect says, okay, I have the information, let me check with my boss. Okay, and who's the boss? The ego. So boss, yeah, what's it? Okay. So now the boss, you know, he says, boss, look, I have all this information received by the mind, and the mind wants to know what to do with it. So now, how do you make a decision? You always have to compare the current or the present situation with what's stored in the memory. That's the only way you can make a decision, right? So if I take a step back, what's in the memory now? It's everything based on our past experiences. Okay? So you experience something, you eat something, you go somewhere, you hear something or see something, etc., etc. Everything is in the memory. But then, as soon as that memory gets this information, guess what the ego does? It puts a label on that. What kind of label? I like it, I dislike it. I love it, I hate it. I want it, I don't want it. I want a repeat experience, I don't want a repeat experience. Okay? Everything gets put with a label there. Okay? So the same thing happened here, you know. So the ego says, okay, let me dive into the memory and I'll let you know what to do with it. So it goes into the memory and it pulls up some instance of another event. What was that? We had the same cake about 10 days ago, same cake, and then ego had put a label there. What did the label read? Divine experience. Delightful, divine, whatever, okay? Most delicious. So he says, very simple, it says divine and delicious, go tell him to do the needful. What did the mind have to do? Extend the arm, grab the cake, everything. Intellect, when it comes back to him, intellect says, oh, you know, I am the decision maker. I'm going to make some private investigation also just to see how things are. Where do you make the investigation? Memory, right? Dips into the memory, pulls out another instance. What was that? A visit to the doctor recently. Blood work done. What does the blood result say? Extremely high, dangerous levels of cholesterol. Okay, so what did the doctor say? Go visit a nutritionist. Okay? So, and what did the nutritionist say?
No cake.
No cake. Nothing that can...
Down with sugars and fat.
Down with sugars and fat. Nothing that can cause further damage to your cholesterol levels. And the intellect is heavily alarmed. Oh my God, I'm not supposed to eat this cake. So it goes back to boss, this is what I find. Guess what the boss says?
I don't want it.
boss says, you're an idiot.
Yeah.
Super idiot. You can't you read the label? One piece of cake. Has one piece of cake killed anybody? Are you stupid not to enjoy this? Alright. So, that's the story of how the mind functions, all right? And this entire focus in the Yoga Sutras by Patanjali is to eventually learn how to diminish the influence of the ego and increase the influence of the intellect. Okay? That's the entire purpose of this yoga sutra philosophy. But only when we do that, as long as the ego is dominant, we are in suffering, we are in pain. Because that's what the ego does. It's going to make us do things which are undesirable, just because they are pleasant. Everything that's pleasant doesn't have to be desirable, right? So there is a distinction we have to start making between what is pleasant and what's desirable. You get that? Okay. So the intellect, when it is functioning without the influence of the ego, it knows what is desirable. Okay, because then it is driven by the pure intuitive wisdom, which exactly knows what's right, what's wrong. Right now, we are influenced by the ego, and that's why we are unable to make the right decision. We make the wrong choices in everything that we do. It's not just food. Food, of course, is a big thing. But whatever, you know, career choices, family choices, choices with the kids, how to handle the kids, how to handle your spouse, things like that. Everything, we are driven by the ego. Okay? You know, you go to your kid's room, this room is messy. Clean it up. Mom, I like it this way, you know, I'm going to, you know, this is what I like. But I'm your mother, I'm telling you. You know, to go do what I say. Where is that coming from? Intellect or the ego?
My ego.
All ego. Okay? You know, parents are in the habit of saying, I'm so proud of you. You know, what does that mean? I am proud of you. I approve of what you're doing. The kid says, I should do only something that makes my mother proud of me or my father proud of me. Right or wrong, that's not the point. Right? That's ego. Now, there's parents' ego is coming into the picture because they are trying to promote only stuff that their own ego likes. Doesn't have to be right or wrong. It doesn't matter in that point. Okay, so you get the idea, right? So that's the whole purpose and the philosophy of yoga. And then what it says is that when you are able to calm the mind, then the seer rests in its own true nature. What does that statement mean? Does it mean anything at all to you?
I mean, I can tell you, like, I don't remember, I read it a while ago, so I don't remember what the commentary says, but to me it means just my true self without all of the stuff that has varied it over the years.
Right. Very good.
Yeah.
So then I begin to recognize my true self, basically. I recognize my true nature, my true being. Without being cluttered by the ego, basically. Okay? So, this brings us to a little bit of a diversion here. Any of you heard this philosophy called Sankhya? S-A-N-K-H-A? No? Okay. There are multiple philosophical streams in the Indian, you know, context. And I'm not going to go through that, but two of the important ones that are, you know, that relate to us, our study, is the yoga philosophy by Patanjali, and then another philosophy called the Sankhya philosophy.
This is the love story.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Sankhya philosophy, all right? Now, the reason I mention this is because Patanjali, Sankhya philosophy is very old. Okay, it's much more ancient compared to the yoga philosophy by Patanjali. Patanjali took some of the very basic concepts, very basic tenets from the Sankhya philosophy and then built his structure around that. So yoga is based largely on the concepts presented in the Sankhya philosophy. Okay. That's the That's why I wanted to mention that. Now, as per that philosophy, and that's the same philosophy that Patanjali has used, there are two entities. Have you heard the term Purusha and Prakriti? Mm-hmm. What's Purusha?
I'm not sure what it is, but we read that story last night and they described it as like two different types of being.
Purusha was like the pure
consciousness.
Yeah, consciousness.
Yeah. Pure soul. Prakriti. Prakriti is everything else. Prakriti is all the material being that we are able to sense through our five senses, through our thoughts. So everything is prakriti, basically, that we can see, feel, touch, whatever.
The physical.
The physical being, the material being is all prakriti. Okay? And that includes our human being, okay? So the entire human being is a part of that. Everything, you see trees, flowers, whatever, okay? Everything is a part of the prakriti, sun, moon, everything. Purusha is pure consciousness, that pure being that you talk about, being the pure entity, being the soul or the atma or, you know, consciousness. That's the only thing that is conscious. Pure consciousness. Prakriti is non-conscious. Prakriti, for its function, has to borrow consciousness from Purusha. Okay? Light of consciousness, as they say. All right. So there's Purusha and there's Prakriti. Okay? And what it says, the seer is the Purusha, basically. Seer is the true self or the true being. True consciousness. Right now what is happening is that pure consciousness is not as pure because it is now embodied and it is merged with the ego or with the prakriti. Okay? So there is a kind of a, you can call it a connection between the two. Okay? So there is no clear understanding. The Purusha doesn't know what or who it is. Okay? And it is completely entangled, so to say, with the prakriti, with the ego, with the mind, with the buddhi, etc. And it thinks this is what it is. And ego, that's the reason why ego takes over. The reason why ego takes over because the Purusha is confused right now. It is entangled with the prakriti. Ego says, I have the chance. I'll take over now. Okay? So the whole purpose is obviously then to, like I said, eliminate the influence of the ego and the prakriti so that the Purusha can shine in its own true light. That's the purpose of the practice of yoga. All right? So that the seer rests in its own true nature. That's the purpose. You get it? Mm-hmm. Now, what happens if you're not able to do that? Otherwise, what happens? If you're not able to control the mind, if you're not able to calm the mind, then whatever is happening in the mind is going to take over. And that's happening is because of the ego. So ego says, I'm the master. So Patanjali says, guys, you have two options. Either control and calm the mind, become happy forever, or allow the mind to control you and stay miserable forever. What do you want to do? That's the question. Okay. So that's the basically, you know, the very fundamental definition of yoga in these four sutras. So from the definition point of view, you know, you want to memorize these four sutras, you know, because they are very important. They completely kind of give you a gist of what yoga is all about. Okay? And then he goes into the discussion of the five vrittis. You know, remember, we said vrittis are the fluctuations or the perturbations that go on in the mind, right? So what he has done, he has kind of broadly put them in five categories. These five vrittis, he calls them, okay? And what I still think I should do is in the interest of time, instead of going through slides now, I'm just going to give you a brief overview of what these vrittis are. And you can always go back and read these slides later, okay? I'll send you the links. So, vrittis are how the mind gets modified, basically. What changes can go on in the mind. So what he said, there are five categories. One is where you get the right kind of knowledge. He says right knowledge. Second, he says the wrong knowledge. Third is the imaginary knowledge. Fourth is the knowledge gained through sleep. And fifth is the knowledge gained through memories. Okay, what's the right kind of knowledge? Then again, he divides right kind of knowledge into three categories. Okay? One is through the five senses. Okay? So, if I'm looking at Jill, I have the right knowledge. Okay? Because I can, whatever image I get, I can match it with the memory. And there's a label there that says Jill. Okay? So I know that this person is Jill. That's the right knowledge. I hear something, I can match it with something that is in the memory, and I can identify this, the sound of a woman, the sound of a man, sound of an animal, etc., etc. You get the idea. Okay? That's the right knowledge. What's wrong knowledge?
You hear someone say something about
them. And you you have misconception. Okay? Mostly it happens, you know, the example they give is in all the Indian literature, the example of wrong knowledge is to recognize a snake in a rope. Has anybody heard that?
Oh, yeah.
Snake in a rope. Every text, you know, they will give you that example. Yeah. Snake in a rope.
Okay.
So the story is, you know, you're going on the road and it's dim light, very late in the evening, and you see something on the road, and it's curled like a, you know, and it looks like a snake to you, and then you run away from out of fear, you run away from there, and then you run into a man who has a flashlight. So this guy says, "Why are you running?" He said, "There's a snake there. Oh, let me check." He put the flashlight on it. It was nothing but a piece of rope. Okay, so the idea is that we have all these wrong notions about things because of ignorance. We were ignorant of this being. Okay, and then what did we need? We needed the light of wisdom, the light of knowledge. To remove that ignorance. Okay? So we were ignorant about this entity being a snake or a rope, but we had to have a flashlight, which is the light of knowledge and wisdom, and that removed our ignorance and we were clear in our understanding. So that's the whole purpose of this yoga, is because it provides us that light of wisdom. Okay? So these are the five. So number two was wrong knowledge. Number three is imaginary knowledge. You hear something, you start imagining things, right? You see something, you start imagining things. Okay? Many things, you know, for example, God. You hear the word God. Everyone has their different imagination what God is. You know, somebody would think it is somebody sitting up in the sky under the behind the clouds and all that. Somebody will say, "Oh, it's pure consciousness." Somebody will have another image. You know, this is a deity, that's God, etc., etc. Everyone has a different imagination. The word time, for example, who knows what time? Every abstract noun, for example, love, hatred. Everyone has a different image of that. Okay, so these are the imaginary things, and of course, we pull stuff from the memory and start imagining all kinds of stuff. Okay, that's imaginary knowledge. And then the number four is sleep. Okay, that also creates an impression in the mind because, first of all, when we are in a state of deep sleep, it's an impression of nothingness, basically. There's nothing going on. But even there, you know, when we wake up, we kind of have an impression whether we slept well or not. That's all based on the impression that's left by the sleep. So that's also a modification of the mind. And memory, we know that. Memory creates all kinds of modifications in the mind. And We think of something that happened 20 years ago and we love that, you know, because we become miserable. Something happened 20 years ago. Now we are miserable. Why? Because we didn't do the right thing at that time, so I'm building stories around it. This is what I should have done. I wish I could live my life over, and now I'm miserable. Okay? That's memory. So those are the five broad categories of changes that can go on in the mind. Okay? And what Patanjali says, that these vrittis, or these perturbations, are the cause which do not allow us to stay focused in our meditation and then allow us to calm the mind. Okay? So then he goes on to say that how do you calm the mind? So he says there are two things that you have to do. Okay? And those two things are, he lists them as, in Sanskrit they are abhyasa and vairagya. Okay? Now what's this abhyasa and vairagya?
Practice and detachment.
Practice and detachment, very good. Abhyasa is practice, and then vairagya is detachment. So he defines, you know, basically both these terms here. Okay? And again, what is abhyasa? Abhyasa is practice. And he defines them with these three attributes. Let me just go to that. Okay, so these are the three attributes he defines for how to define the term practice, abhyasa. And these three attributes are that something that has to be done for a long time, that's number one attribute, long period of time, without interruption, that's number two, and then with earnest, reverential attention and devotion, that's number three. So your practice should have these three attributes. Okay? What's long time mean?
Most of your life.
Can you calm the mind if you practice it most of your life?
Maybe.
Maybe.
At least a little
bit. Maybe?
Yeah. You get better at it.
You get better at it, but how long will it take to calm the mind eventually?
Maybe your whole life.
Can you guarantee that you will achieve it in one life? Then what do?
Keep trying.
Keep trying in a future life.
Okay.
So long time implies multiple lifetimes. Because the objective is so difficult to attain, Patanjali says you cannot attain it in one lifetime. You cannot. But you don't start everything with a clean slate, every life with a clean slate. You start where you left off. Mm-hmm. That's the whole karma theory, you know, and I'm going to talk briefly about that if I have time. Okay? Mm-hmm. Karma theory. All right? So, what he says is that you have to practice for a long time, uninterrupted. The second attribute is uninterrupted. That means no interruption, no gaps. If you decide to practice every day, it has to be every day. If you decide to practice 24 hours a day, it has to be that way. Okay? All the way. And with a sense of very earnest, reverential attention and devotion. And that comes through a lot of understanding of you know exactly what you're doing, you know how good it is for you, you know its potential benefits, you've learnt it from a guru who you trust, you know, all these things are a part of this trust, faith, understanding, and devotion. Okay? That means you have trust in your guru, because the guru has told you all this, your teacher, whoever the teacher is. Trust in that teacher. Trust in your own learning. You've studied a lot of literature, you've studied a lot of texts to get to that understanding. Trust those. And with that sense of devotion, you practice that. Okay? So that's the practice. And then what is vairagya, or the detachment? So what Patanjali says, and again not going to go through these in detail, but Patanjali says there are two levels of detachment. Two levels. Two. One he calls the lower level, and the other is the higher level, basically. Okay? So What's the lower level of detachment? First of all, do you understand the difference between the term detachment and non-attachment? Is there a difference or are they the same?
Maybe non-attachment is not getting into it in the first place, and detachment is you're in it, but you're going to step outside.
Perfect. So very good. That's all I wanted to clarify.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good. Okay. So you're attached to coffee, you know. You must have a coffee at 7 in the morning or at 10 in the morning or whatever. Otherwise, you get a headache or whatever. Huh. That's attachment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So if you want to get rid of that, you have to detach yourself from
right.
it. You've never had a cigarette, don't get attached to it. That's non-attachment.
Right.
Get that idea?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so non-attachment and detachment. Mm-hmm. Close, but mm-hmm. slightly different.
So is non-attachment more passive, would you say?
It's active. Everything is active because mm-hmm. you can active in the sense you're controlling your mind.
Yeah.
Okay, somebody offers you a glass of wine first time, it's active mind. It's active.
Yeah.
Your mind has to decide whether you want to take that or not to take it.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody offers you a cigarette or marijuana, you know. So your mind, it's active decision that you have to make finally.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not passive.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay?
That makes sense. Yeah.
It's all active. Okay? So I just brought marijuana because they said they have legalized it in some states now, you know, you can go and buy it.
Yeah.
On the very first day, they had about $4 million sales.
Yeah.
Go have fun. Okay. So, the lower level of detachment, what Patanjali says, is the one where you can completely detach yourself from any attachment through the five senses. What does that mean? You enjoy looking at something, you enjoy some taste, you enjoy touching something. Get rid of the attachment at that level. No, when I started reading the sutra, then I saw this, and it says, finally it says, oh, this is the lower level of detachment. Oh my God, I said, if this is lower level, what's the higher level? This is hard enough for me. You know, I like a certain food, I like a certain type of music. You know, how do I get, how do I detach myself from all that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's hard enough, right? But that's what he says. He says, this is the lower level of attachment, of non-attachment. Okay? Five senses, or craving for things that you've heard. And again, the commentators give the example that some people say, okay, if you do this, you'll eventually attain heaven. So don't get attached to that. In the Indian context, in the Indian philosophy context, going to heaven itself is no good because you have to come back. Only from the human birth can you achieve salvation. That's what they say. If you go to heaven, you have to come back as a human being again to gain salvation. Okay, so they said don't even get attached to heaven. Or anything like that. All right.
Is the higher level achieving control of your mind?
Higher level is when you have transcended the attachment which comes through the three gunas. Have you heard the term guna?
Oh, yeah. Yes. We just
what's guna?
States of being. Three states of being.
Three states of? Three entities, basically. Okay, three. See, what they say, again, it's a part of the Sankhya philosophy, that everything in Prakriti, everything in this material being, is a composite of three qualities, you can call them. They are called gunas. What are the three gunas? Does anybody know their names? Sattva.
Yeah.
Rajas. Not Raha, Rajas. R-A-J-A-S, Rajas.
Yeah, and
Tamas.
Tamas.
So again, just let's repeat that because this is very important. You will get to this. Sattva.
Satya.
Sattva.
Sattva.
Not Satya.
Okay, Sattva.
How do you spell
S-A-T-T-V-A.
Sattva
is purity, balance, goodness, all that good stuff. Okay? Sattva, not satya. Satya is truth.
Yeah, that's,
oh, yeah.
So don't confuse the two, okay? Sattva. What is rajas?
Rajas, that's like fiery,
overactive.
Active, yeah. Active, aggressive, gung-ho, type A, you know, all that stuff. Ambitious, okay? Desiring things. That's all a part of rajas. Includes desiring good and bad things both, you know. So, activity. And then what is tamas?
That's like sleepy, like.
Dullness, sleepiness, like I said. Same thing that we heard the term mudha, you know, that's also dullness.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
So,
all these three.
Those, that kind of way.
Hmm?
It's not attachment to being any of those things.
So what these three things do is what way they are the things that make us do things. Mm-hmm. Everything in the mind is happening because of these three gunas. Everything. Mm-hmm. Okay? So our actions, our thoughts, our behavior patterns, our emotions, they are all controlled by the gunas. Whatever guna is dominant at a given time, that's how we will be doing things. Okay? So when you guys decided to join this program, your sattva guna was more dominant. The assumption, right?
Mm-hmm.
For somebody else, you may have suggested, hey, let's go and join Dharma's class. Ah, we'll do it next time, next year. Maybe the rajas was more important at that time. Or maybe tamas was more dominant at that time. Who knows? Okay? So all our feelings, thoughts, actions, movements, everything is controlled by whichever guna is dominant at a given time. And this dominance keeps shifting all the time. Constant change in their dominance. One moment, sattva is dominant. The very next moment, you might be tamas, you know, dominant. You're reading something very nice and spiritual and all that, and suddenly, I want to sleep now.
Mm.
That tamas takes over.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Or, oh my God, I forgot. I had to go there. Rajas takes over. You know, you're doing something. Oh, no, I forgot. Go into the car and run away. You know, rajas takes over. Mm-hmm. Things happen all the time. Right? Okay? And this is what he says, that when you're able to understand these three gunas and then go and transcend the influence of these three gunas, that's the ultimate form of detachment. Because then you're not going to be attached to sattva or rajas or tamas.
But why wouldn't you want to be attached to sattva?
Sattva, see, again, sattva is going to, it's a bondage. And I'm going to, when we go to Bhagavad Gita, there's a shloka there which says, sattva itself is bondage. Even though it is bondage, something good, but it's bondage. And when you go to Bhagavad Gita, I'll read that shloka to you. It's in the understanding there. Okay, it's bondage. You're binding yourself to something good, something positive, maybe. But that's binding. If that doesn't happen, then you'll be miserable. That's attachment.
Okay. Right.
So you have to transcend all these three gunas. Okay. You know, this whole concept of gunas is very important. Bhagavad Gita is full of that. Okay? So, you have to understand that concept a little more in depth. Okay? So that's all the concept of gunas. And then he says, that's what you will do to transcend those, and then non-attachment, full, total detachment. Okay? And that's the highest level of detachment which will eventually lead you to full liberation, total liberation. That's when you have attained your true self, the state. Okay? So this is all in chapter 1 of the sutras. Okay? And then the rest, I mean, this is the beginning part up to number 15. And the rest of it is a lot of discussion on the concept of Ishvara. Does anyone know what Ishvara is?
The highest form of
God, yeah. So it's basically the concept of God, which is introduced by Patanjali. Okay, in the Sankhya philosophy, there's no mention of God. Okay, it's purely free of God. It's all pure philosophy. No, there was no need to mention any God. So Sankhya doesn't say. Patanjali introduced God because it was a common concept in the human, you know, in the culture at that time. God, concept of God was there. And he says that you have to devote, you have to have a sense of devotion to God, this Ishvara, and that will also help you calm your mind eventually, lead you to the state of samadhi. So that's the kind of concept he talks about in chapter 1 a lot. He defines God, what God is, and what are the attributes that this special entity, higher entity called God has, and how devotion to that entity can lead you to your samadhi. Okay, so that's one part of this chapter 1. And then there is a very fairly detailed discussion on different stages of samadhi. Okay, so he takes you through multiple different stages of samadhi. When you sit through meditation, you'll go through these stages, you know, stage by stage by stage. Eventually you lead to a state, it will lead to the final state of samadhi, which he calls seedless samadhi. Okay? So again, the concept here is that in the concept of meditation that Patanjali advocates, he says you have to meditate on an object. Okay? So you have to pick an object of meditation and then kind of repeatedly stay in tune with that object in the mind. That's the concept of meditation presented by Patanjali. He talks about the sound of Om as being one of the objects, Om, that we chanted earlier. Okay? And that represents a seed, because that object is going to stay in the mind as a seed, and that seed can actually give more thoughts, more fruits, as you can see, you know. But eventually he says you have to go beyond all this meditation which is based on a seed, which is the object of meditation, and become seedless in your meditation. That's the final state or the stage of samadhi or meditation. Seedless samadhi. That's the last sutra in chapter 1. You've attained seedless samadhi. Okay? So that's chapter 1. Then, chapter 2, like I said, is all about introduction to the eight limbs of yoga. Okay, so you already are very familiar with the eight limbs of yoga, right? But let me see if I can. Okay. Okay, let me just very quickly kind of introduce you to the second chapter. And like I said, what it starts out with is the concept of the five kleshas. Okay, so this is where he gives us an understanding what suffering is, what stress is. You know, we all talk about stress in life. And he talks about these five different kind of levels of stress, five different causes of stress. Again, we don't have too much time, so let me just very quickly summarize them. The number one cause of all stress, all suffering, all pain is not knowing our true identity. I'm not aware of who I am, okay? That's called avidya or ignorance. That's number one. And what does that do? That causes the ego to raise its ugly head, right? So the number two cause of suffering is ego, okay? So the word he uses is asmita for that in Sanskrit, all right? So ego is number two. And what does the ego do? It puts a label on every experience, good, bad, like it, dislike it, love it, hate it, okay? And those labels are called likes and dislikes in the language of this. And they're the number three and four, raga and dvesha. Those are the causes of suffering. Because if we like something, if we don't get it, we suffer. If we dislike something and we get it, we suffer. Okay? And then the final reason for suffering, he says, abhinivesha, which is fear of death, fear of change. Death is the biggest change. Any kind of change brings fear in the life, in the mind, any kind of change. And that causes suffering. Like every change, okay, you think of any major change in life, it's going to cause us some stress, some suffering. So that's called abhinivesha. So these five, ignorance, egoism, attachment, hatred, and clinging to bodily life are the five causes of suffering, so to say. Okay? So he goes into a lot of discussion in this chapter on these five causes of suffering. Okay? Then he goes into this whole concept of karma theory. Has everyone heard the term karma? What does it mean?
Selfless service?
No, I'm talking karma theory.
For every, it's like Newton's law, right? Yeah. Hmm? Every action, there's an equal and opposite.
Reaction. Okay, the basic, in English, the statement most commonly used is, as you sow, so shall you reap.
Right, yeah.
What goes around comes back, okay? So that's the karma theory. And he spends a fair amount of time on explaining what karma theory is. Okay, that's in chapter 2. Okay, so basically what we're saying is that, you know, whatever we do in this life is going to come back to us either in this life or in a future birth. Okay, alright, and there are three types of karma that are usually mentioned. Again, that's not part of Patanjali. Every commentator will tell you that there are three types of karma. One is called the sanchita karma, or this, the whole bag full of karma, so to say. The total bag, total collection, total bank balance of karma. Okay? Out of that total bank balance, every time a new birth happens, you are dished out a certain subset of that karma which you have to fulfill in this life. Okay? So that's called prarabdha karma. Okay? So there's a whole bag of karma, which is the full bank balance. Out of that you're given a certain amount which you have to spend in this life. Okay? Which will include things like, you know, you are born into such and such family, in such and such race, with such and such color, your height will be so much, your weight will be so much, and when you are 40, you know, you might get sick, or etc., etc. All that is given in your karma bag, which has to be fulfilled in this life. And then as you are living your life, you generate karma. That's called future karma. Okay? And so all these three are a part of the karma bag. All right? And then again, when you die, something is dished out of that karma theory. All right? So that's all given in the second chapter. Okay? So now...
So the three types of bad karma?
No, the three types of karma.
The three types of karma, yes. The bag?
Bag, yeah. Oh, sorry. Bag, and the current, which I'm going through,
yeah.
And then the future karma that I'm going to generate in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Alright, so those are the things that are, and then in the second chapter it also goes into a very detailed discussion of this whole theory of Sankhya. So there's a complete element of the Sankhya philosophy. It talks about Purusha, Prakriti, what are the attributes of Prakriti, what are the attributes of Purusha and all that. That's all a very big part of the second chapter. Okay, the whole Sankhya theory. Alright, and then, again, you know, just to again go through this very, the eight limbs of yoga, we all know that. Does everyone know these eight limbs of yoga? Can everyone name them quickly?
Mm-hmm.
Dharana.
Dharana.
Dharana. Not dharana. Dharana. Next one. Dhyana.
Dhyana.
Yes.
Dhyana.
Yes.
Dhyana. And samadhi.
and samadhi. Okay, very good. Yeah. Okay, so now you know these are the eight limbs of yoga, and this is the sutra number 28, which kind of introduces you to the concept of these eight limbs of yoga. The eight limbs of yoga are defined in the next sutra, but this is the sutra which is very important because it introduces you to the concept of these eight limbs of yoga. So, there are again three things mentioned here which I want to emphasize as a part of this sutra. So, he says, by the practice of the limbs of yoga, the impurities of the mind, they dwindle away. Okay, impurities of the mind. But remember, yoga is all, the purpose of yoga is to make the mind pure. Okay? What are the impurities of the mind? What are we talking about?
The kleshas.
Kleshas. What else? Everything.
Everything, yeah. The ego.
Ego. Everything causes impurities of the mind, right?
Yeah.
And there are things like we always talk about anger, jealousy,
yeah.
Hatred, greed,
yeah.
Jealousy and all that stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there are six things mentioned always in our literature. Okay?
Oh.
Impurities of the mind.
Right.
All right? So that's what he says, that when you practice these eight limbs of yoga, the impurities will go down. Then what happens? The light of wisdom dawns. Pure intuitive wisdom. Pure intuitive knowledge. That comes through. Okay? Okay? That's number two. Things happen. The thing that happens. You have to have the ego lose its power before you can see the light of wisdom. Otherwise, ego puts a lid on that. It puts a cover on that. So the impurities, when they go away, that means your impressions, they are clarified, they are cleansed out. Ego has very little to do at that time. Then you can see the light of true wisdom coming through. Okay? And that, when you have that light, that vision of that light, that leads you to the ultimate goal of yoga, which is to attain full discriminatory wisdom. At that time, you have completely eliminated the influence of the ego and you have completely realized your true nature, which is called self-realization. Okay? So that's what the goal of yoga is, or the practice of these eight limbs of yoga. So Sutra 228 talks about these, what the yoga can promise you, and then of course he goes into the yamas, niyamas and all that. Alright? So those are the eight limbs of yoga, all right? And then it goes into the discussion of samadhi and meditation in the third chapter, as we said. And again, very detailed discussion on different, or what goes on in the mind when you are in a state of meditation. What are the different changes and transformations that go on in the mind? Okay? And that's in the third chapter. All right. Now, one thing I just want before it's 11 o'clock. We wanted to take a break at this point, but let me take 2 minutes now. What's the meaning of the word yoga? What's the literal meaning? Literal Sanskrit meaning of word yoga.
Union.
Union. Union, when you say union, what does that imply? Uniting something, right? When you unite things, right? What are the things you're uniting with union?
Mind, body, soul.
Mind, body, soul. Okay. So you're uniting mind, body and soul. What does that mean? Does anybody know what that means?
Becoming whole.
Hmm? Now remember, the purpose of yoga is Kaivalya. Remember, I mentioned the word Kaivalya, that's the name of the last chapter, Kaivalya Pada. And Kaivalya was isolation or or detachment for sort of, you know, freedom. Freedom from bondage. Bondage of what?
My impurities.
Bondage of, like I said, the Purusha, the pure soul, is right now bonded with the mind, with the body and all that, because it's thinking that it's the same thing as the ego. That's the bonding, that's the bondage that we have. We want to detach from that bondage. That means we want to separate the soul and make it live. That's why we said this. The sutra number 2 or 3 was, when the mind is clear, when the mind is calm, the seer rests in its pure, true nature, which is isolated from this bondage with the mind and body and the ego. So what does that mean? That means that it's this union which is the cause of the suffering, which is the union which is the cause of the problem. We are uniting the soul with the mind and body. That's the whole reason for suffering. Okay, I want to emphasize this point very deeply, because most people don't understand this concept. Hold on a second. Why am I getting this? Oh, okay. So this goes into theory of karma. The pain that has not yet come is unavoidable. The cause of that avoidable pain is the union of the Purusha and the seen and the Prakriti. The pain, the cause of suffering is the union between the soul. Purusha is the soul. And the Prakriti is what mind-body is all composed of. So the suffering is caused by that union, because we are bonding the two together. We are not realizing our true nature.
We are identifying
with what we have in the mind and body. So my message, that the reason I wanted to bring it, is my message is, please understand this very clearly. Yoga, the meaning of the word yoga is union. It's true, but in a different context. And if you start saying union of mind, body and soul, you're creating problems here. Right now it says here. If you say, I'm going to unite my mind, body and soul, you're creating all kinds of suffering. That's exactly the cause. That's exactly the whole purpose of yoga, is to eliminate that bondage, that eliminate that union. Okay, so the purpose of yoga is to disunite the body, mind and the soul. Very important, okay? Don't get into that confusion. It's not Western. It's ignorance. It's not knowing what. When you say mind, body, and soul, you don't even know what it means. You just heard it, therefore you repeat it.
Right.
You know, without knowing or without understanding the context, without understanding the meaning, it's just something you've heard, so you repeat it.
Yeah, that's a huge misconception, because that's immediately what I thought when you asked.
Right.
Yeah.
So, look at the sutras. Okay, this very clearly it says here. The cause of the avoidable pain is the union of the seer and Purusha and the Prakriti. And then he goes into the other discussion here, you know. Like I said, complete Sankhya philosophy. That's all based on that. All right?
So basically we want to detach the soul. We want to detach the soul, which is the true essence,
yes,
from the body and the
right
mind.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. That's called Kaivalya. That's the name of the chapter 4. Kaivalya means that full detachment of the soul from the mind-body complex. Okay, so I just wanted to bring this out, because most people, they blindly say yoga is union of mind, body and soul. That's not true. Read the commentary of Vyasa, which is the most authoritative commentary, I said. He defines yoga as the state of samadhi. the literal meaning of the multiple meanings of yoga, right? Mm-hmm. And the meaning that is applicable, that's really relevant to us, is the meaning which is samadhi, mind, state of mind which is totally calm, peaceful. Okay? Union is the meaning of yoga. There's right. No question about that. Mm-hmm. In a different context. Okay? So don't get me wrong, the multiple meanings. Yeah. All right, let's take a break. I think it's a good time to...